Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Avery Alder, the designer of beloved and influential games such as The Quiet Year, Monster Hearts, Dream Askew, and most recently, Going for Broke. Avery, welcome to the table.
Hey.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. Stoked to have you. I think that, you know, when we first started this podcast, we made a big master list of people, and I think your name has been on that list since we launched the show, so we're so excited to finally have you on.
This is one of those moments where we're like, we should hit up Avery Alder, and then we were like, Avery Alder doesn't want to talk to us. So we're so glad to get you on.
But yeah, so today we really wanted to kind of sit down with you for a discussion about like the legacy and influence of your game designs and how you continue to design as that legacy and influence spreads around you, what that feels like kind of emotionally, what it's like to see that like design-wise and how it affects your own designs. But I want to start with something that comes from your website and your brand as Buried Without Ceremony. Could you tell us about this meaning behind Buried Without Ceremony as a phrase and a publishing imprint? Because I think it'll bring out some like great ideas for the rest of the conversation.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, that's a title that I came up with 19 years ago. And so we're traveling way back in time to when I was a very dramatic teenager. The idea behind Buried with Ceremony is to capture the fact that when we play role-playing games, these stories, they can be really profound, they can be meaningful, they can give us new insights into who we are and the world we exist in and the world that we want to exist in the future. And so they can give us so much, but at the same time, they're little make-believe games that we play with our friends for no audience and for no purpose. And so these are experiences that we get to pretend are ours and we get to take with us for as long as we want to, but we also have that freedom to bury them without ceremony, to say like, this was play, as meaningful or as meaningless as we wanted it to be.
I really love that sense, because I've always seen Buried Without Ceremony as like your imprint, and I never thought to investigate it further. I just thought it was a nice name, but I really love that sentiment. And I think we're going to talk about this throughout this conversation, it recontextualizes what role-playing games can be. Like, it's a reminder of what they are, even though you can get very, very deep into them and have these very real emotional sensations and real emotional experiences. It is a game. It can be set aside without really thinking about it. It can be treated that way, and that's kind of the beauty of these games. I'm excited to dive into this. Okay. To start, I'd love to hear about, because you've had a long career in games, and as you said, you came up with this name for Buried Without Ceremony 19 years ago. Like, you're kind of beholden to something you decided almost two decades ago. What has your design ethos been from when you started to now, and how has it evolved and changed as you become a more experienced game designer and have put out more and more games?
Okay, so when I was first designing games, the first game that I designed and took all the way to publication, and what I would consider, even though it's not technically my first game, what I would consider to be my first game is a game called Perfect that was later re-released as Perfect Unrevised. And Perfect is like a dark Victorian game about criminals in a world in which like brainwashing and conditioning is really advanced. And so it's kind of like a V for Vendetta, Clockwork Orange, that kind of space. And that game started from the premise of, what if your character sheet told you all the things that you can't do? And so really trying to like design with negative space and take a design assumption that was kind of felt like it was written in stone and see what happened if we flipped it on its head. The next thing I designed was Ribbon Drive. And, you know, I feel like it's in a similar ethos, but if I was to be asked how to explain how, I'm not sure that I could. But it feels similar in some way. So I think my early work was playing around with negative space, playing around with flipping design assumptions on their head. And that's really what I maybe think of now as like clever design, clever in the pejorative sense, in that it's like design that proves how smart I am or how interesting I am as a designer. And Ribbon Drive, I still love, I stand by it. But I think that the shift in my design ethos over time has been to think a lot more about what it means for the player to be interfacing with the game and what it means for the game to exist outside of myself and outside of my control. And what it means to like sculpt invitations that I'm not there to witness the engagement and also that aren't about me.
I love that you talked about this idea of the game, how a game exists outside of yourself. And I think that this is a great transition into talking about The Quiet Year, because this is a game that's been around now for 12 years and I think has had a widespread influence where you couldn't probably hear all the stories of playing The Quiet Year if you endeavored to go out and seek them. And it's fun because The Quiet Year is one of those games that now, like, as a newer designer, feels like a lot of the things it's talking about, like of map making and world building and, you know, a concrete, like, sudden ending driven by cards, feel like table stakes in design. But I have to imagine back in 2013, these were kind of experimental, kind of new ideas. So I'm curious, like, what were those things when you first made The Quiet Year that were you experimenting with the form and trying new stuff that maybe we take for granted in 2025 as givens?
Yeah. So The Quiet Year, I first started developing it in 2011. And at the time, there weren't a lot of games that operated in that tradition, but there weren't none either. And specifically, Microscope by Ben Robbins, although you don't construct a map, you construct a timeline, feels very similar. It feels very like you're playing with the zoom dial and you're doing world building that occasionally touches upon role play. And so those games came out around the same time. So there was clearly something in the water in the Pacific Northwest. And Ben and I had played at story game meetups several times. So there was some cross-pollination or parallel thinking or something going on. But also Tony Dowler, also from Seattle, had put out How to Host a Dungeon a year earlier, I believe. And so if we're talking about like where to map making games come from within the tabletop role-playing game tradition, it's definitely Tony Dowler and not me. I actually never played How to Host a Dungeon, but going to Go Play, I witnessed people playing Tony's game and witnessed the physicality of it. And I think I might have also seen it at Gen Con at a booth, and then shortly afterwards designed a game that operated in a very similar like physical production space where people are making a map together, where people are moving, sliding tokens around on the map. So The Quiet Year is a design that I think now a lot of its ideas are much more taken for granted. And I think that's partially because of its impact, but also they didn't come from me. They came from Ben Robbins and Tony Dowler.
That feels like an interesting thing that isn't the first time we've heard it. It is like, you know, sometimes the thing that spreads an idea in game design isn't the first, but it is like, you know, the most influential. Like it comes from like everything is a lineage. I don't have a question here. It's just it has an interesting thought occurring to me.
It's a thing we've experienced on this show a lot in that when I think of world building games, The Quiet Year is like the world building game. And a lot of that has to do with like popularity and what I've seen and what I've heard and what's been on the shelf of my friendly local gaming store. But we've had this a couple times where there have been things that we mark as our beginnings on our experience based on a certain type of game. And in reality, those things are based on a much larger lineage and have a much greater trail to their origin point, which is always interesting to find, start at what I think is the beginning of the trail and then be like, oh no, there's a whole other trail back here. You got to go down. And it's fun to explore that area.
Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of my success as a designer has just been like riding the right coattails at the right moment and like knowing how to slingshot myself off of those coattails.
Mm-hmm. Hey, that's a skill. Don't knock it.
Yeah. I guess digging into that more, I mean, like, what would you say like are those key moments in The Quiet Year's journey where you were like, you know, you grabbed that, I won't say right on the coattails because I think it's a great game, but that deserves the attention it gets. But like, what were those key moments that you sort of were able to slingshot the game's trajectory with?
Yeah, okay. So just one very crucial one comes to mind. When I first designed The Quiet Year, it didn't use a deck of cards. It used a deck of cards. It didn't use a traditional deck of playing cards. I think I had about 20 prompts and you would cycle through 5 in a season, or maybe 40 and you cycle through 10 in a season, something like that. And I was playtesting the game with Jackson Tegu, another designer who there was a lot of cross-pollination between us in our early work. We hung out a lot. And Jackson sat down to play the Quiet Year with me. I explained the rules. They like nodded knowingly, but then patiently played through the entire session before asking, do you know about the structure of a playing card deck? And I was like, I mean, yes, I can tell you how it's built. And Jackson was like, no, do you understand what it means? And that question was like the spark of like, oh, the thing you're about to say is going to dramatically alter the course of this game. Go for it. And so Jackson broke down for me. There are 13 ranks, as there are 13 moons in a year. There are 4 suits, as there are 4 seasons. There is the light half of the deck and the dark half of the deck, as there is the light half of the year and the dark half of the year marked by equinoxes. And just broke down the whole structure of the deck. And then that was, I think, the second to last major design shift. Because the moment that was explained, I was like, okay, well, that's the structure of the game right there. Great. So that was a crucial moment that shaped the development. And then the other was just figuring out how contempt worked. Contempt used to have mechanical effects. You could cash a certain amount of contempt in to justify a selfish or detrimental action, something that like a faction within the community would do that put the community at risk. At one point, there was even like factions in the game that I tested for like kind of one cycle of playtesting. But ultimately being like, no, this is a social indicator mechanic and nothing else. And I hadn't seen a lot of those mechanics that are like, what I'm doing with this mechanic is I'm communicating to you in a way that is physically unavoidable that I'm upset. And it's always funny to me because like talking to people, sometimes people will say like, okay, but like, I wish contempt tokens did something. And I'm always like, oh, wow, they do something. I am devastated. I say something and someone takes a little skull and puts it in front of them. Yeah. If they don't do anything in your mind, like, that is telling on yourself.
Sure.
this should hurt, my guy.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's a little skull that says I'm mad at you silently. So, yeah.
That's the game. You don't get enough of that. There's something really interesting about the Quiet Year that I'm curious to hear your perspective on, because when I was first introduced to the Quiet Year, I think it was either through like maybe the Adventure Zone or some actual play podcast that described the Quiet Year as like, hey, we use this as like a world building tool for our game. And so when I finally actually read the Quiet Year, I was surprised to realize that like at the end of the Quiet Year, the Frost Wardens come and like the world is kind of destroyed. And it's meant to be a much more designed to be a more like contained experience. I'm curious your perspective on once you put something out into the world, it is for the masses. They get to I make what I want to make and they eat it how they want to eat it, which is a quote that's been really stuck in my mind recently. How has your experience been seeing a game that you made take on slightly different life than maybe what you initially intended?
That quote that you just shared, the I'm going to make it how I want to make it and they're going to eat it how they want to eat it. That was on one of the interviews that you posted kind of recently, I think sometime in the last 6 months. And I remember hearing that and being really struck by it as well.
To give credit, it was Erica Badu said that to Donald Glover in response to some question he made. And every time I hear it, I'm just like, that makes me feel a little easier as someone who puts things out in the world, I think.
Okay, well, that makes sense that it's Erica Badu. Everything she's ever said is gold.
Yeah, exactly, right?
So The Quiet Year got a boost in sales and attention and kind of like reach when Friends at the Table used it to set up one of their seasons. And I think that was their Blades in the Dark season, Marialda. And then it got another significantly larger bump in sales and attention and reach when the Adventure Zone used it to set up a D&D campaign. And so multiple times in its lifespan, it's gotten an influx of people interested in it because it was used in a way that I never intended and wouldn't ever suggest to somebody. The like, you can use this to set up a D&D campaign feels like the exact opposite of the thing I'm attempting to do, but has been really meaningful for people. And I think that that's maybe part of the reason that I mentioned earlier that it feels like my design ethos has shifted away from thinking of myself as clever auteur in at the heart of the play experience because I'm designing the game, and more like, I don't know, I'm like some weird hermit off to the side who occasionally comes out with, you know, shows up to the village square, and I'm like, I have these wonderful gifts, and people take them and do whatever they want with them. And so it took me a while to feel like, cool, I'm on board with that. People can use this game to do what they want with it, because I was really precious about my own sense of positioning within the play experience as a designer. And I had to let that go in order to be like, actually, it's cool. It's cool when D&D people start their session by thinking about community and by doing collaborative world building, because D&D could use more of those things. Why would I be upset with that? Also, it's making me money, and I need money to pay for living.
Yeah, yeah.
And it gives you the space to make more games, and we all want that.
Occasionally, the thought strikes me that The Quiet Year doesn't seem to me very well suited to do campaign setup world building. And I'm like, oh, if that was the goal, was to put out a campaign setup world building game, I could do a much better job of that than The Quiet Year, I'm pretty sure. So occasionally I got down the rabbit hole of trying to design that game before remembering that I don't really like playing long form world building immersive campaigns. Mm-hmm. So why would I create a tool to set that up?
It feels like one of those things you do on your own where it's just like, I need to prove it to myself that I could do it better this way. This doesn't need to be for anybody else, but it lets me know that, like, if this was the plan, this is what it would have been.
Right. And that ties back into the thing I was saying about, like, clever design, right? Of like, I'd be designing that to prove to myself and to prove to others that it could be done in a way that was much more satisfying. But that's like a design exercise. That's not a setup for a play experience.
There's a thing I've been doing in terms of like that that clever design aspect is a word I've been using a lot, both pejoratively and positively. And it's really, I decide in the moment which one it is saying something is like cute. Like, that's a cute idea. And I, every time I use it, I'm using it slightly different. Like, sometimes I'm like, oh, that's a really cute idea. Like, that's clever and fun, and I like it because of that. And sometimes it's like, oh, that's cute. Sure. And it's so, that somehow is the word that I've anchored to be my point of, I say that word, and I'm still deciding whether or not it's positive or negative as I say it.
I love cute as, like, a multivalent container that can just hold whatever your tone suggests that it holds in any given moment. That's great. In Magic, the Gathering podcasting world, there's a draft-based podcast called Limited Resources.
Great show.
And they have this thing that they say really frequently where they'll explain the conceit of a card, right? They'll explain, like, okay, well, this mechanic interacts with this mechanic to produce this unusual effect. And then they'll say, that's the joke. And it's almost never a punchline. It's like, here's a conceit. Yes. Here is a way in which this card hooks into a core mechanic of the set in an unusual way. Occasionally, it will be a punchline. Occasionally, it will be like, because it's got double strike, but it's got zero power on your turn. That's the joke. But more often, it's just pointing out how the conceit comes together. And it's one of those things where I use that in conversation with, like, normal humans, forgetting that that's the joke already has a meaning in the real world. And then I have to be like, back up and be like, sorry, that's another magicism. Let me say it a different way.
That's a very colloquial metaphor.
Another magicism, because you've already said one before in the conversation. Yeah.
Right, because I described something as gas over and over again, and then I had to hilarious. Be like, right, okay, so there's lands.
Oh, I love that.
Now I'm just thinking of all the... Sorry, I'm just thinking of all the magic terms that now I can turn into idioms that my friends won't understand. I'll come up with some and I'll post them somewhere.
It's kind of interesting because it's like, it's one of those things where I feel like not only do players take your game and interpret it in their own way and use it in another way, but then, like, designers then build off of the design of that imagined version of your game. Like, I feel like then, like, The Quiet Year got used to be like a pre-campaign setting builder. And then there is like a school of games that came to be that are pre-campaign setting builders that play with the form kind of the quiet year, and also reference things like Microscope and stuff, which is more specifically able to be used for that.
So I used to work as a magician. I've been interested in magic, and specifically close-up magic, for my entire life. And my favorite, one of my like two or three favorite magicians, but possibly my favorite, is this guy named Derek Delgaudio. And I went, when I was way too broke to do it, I flew to LA to see him and Helder Gumeres do a limited run show at the Geffen Playhouse. And then when he was in New York, he made a show called In and of Itself that was supposed to run for like 5 weeks or something and ran for 2.5 years. I saw it like three times. It was like one of those experiences, one of those pieces of media that is like fundamental to the way I think about what I do. And in it, there's a section where he has, midway through the show, he has a book that is like described as like a tome or like a navigational chart that sailors would use. And he gives the book to someone in the audience and has them leave the show, write down what they think happens in the rest of the show, and then come back for the following performance. And he did this for like 1,000 shows, and the person always came back. And the idea of it is that when sailors were sailing by celestial navigation, there would be days when the navigator could not see the stars because there was too much clouds overhead. But they still needed to track in the logbook what they expected things to be. So they would write down the expected placement of the stars and navigate by that. And then the next time that the clouds were open, they could write down the new, like the true navigation. But because of that, this is a log. This is a book that is made up of both real and fictional parts that is entirely true at the same time. And that's the same way this like design happens. It's not only things are iterated on what actually is there, but also it is iterated on the things that we imagine to be there, the things that we create from it in a really interesting way. But it, Elliot, you saying that really like stuck in my head of like the way things evolve are not just A to B. It's also A is iterated on, and then we evolve from that iteration that is now so far from A that C can hardly be said to be related to A, but it still is through this weird circuitous path.
Yeah, I mean, I think most development is from A to C, and if you asked the designer what B consisted of, they would not be able to explain it. And if they were able to explain it, they would be a teacher, not as a designer, probably, because it's really hard to explain B.
You're kind of filling in B with hindsight. Like, you never go A, B, C. You go A, C, huh. what did I skip over? What step did I skip? What weird path did I take?
Yeah.
Man, games are cool.
Games are cool.
Games are rad as hell.
I'm kind of reminded, you know, a couple conversations we've had in the last year, one of which is Alex Roberts, who did For the Queen and Starcrossed, and another which is Jay Dragon. And in both these conversations, we got a little bit at the idea of like kind of the personal journey you have to take when you have a game that is like this successful and like has like a broad reach. Like Alex talked about the pressure of like after For the Queen and Starcrossed, like, do I know how to make a game as good as these two games I've made? And then Jay kind of struggles with this idea of like being beholden to the statement they were making when writing Wander Home. Like, and like, do I still agree with that statement? I'm curious with The Quiet Year, 12 years from release, like on the personal side, like how do you feel about the game's legacy? Do you still agree with what you were trying to say with the game when it came out? Like, how is that kind of the personal feelings on it changed?
Yeah. Okay. So I think that The Quiet Year, if there was a premise to it, which it doesn't start with a premise, it wasn't constructed didactically, but if there is a premise baked into the game, it's that when you are attempting to work with other people, especially when you are attempting to work in community, and especially when you're attempting to work towards a greater good of some type, the path forward is constructed entirely of compromises. You have the best of intentions, and obviously you would like to create all of the necessary context, container, resources, and capacities to thrive. And obviously you would like to consult with everyone deeply, form an entirely egalitarian, consensus-driven decision-making model that honors and respects the desires of everyone who participates in your community, but also the greater community and the greater earth, and that respects the trees and that respects everything, and that is done in an ethical and sustainable way. And obviously also you want to get shit done as fast as possible because people are suffering in real time and we don't have time to sit around and like have a sprawling process about our feelings while we like occupy a place of privilege and other people are out there dying because we're not just doing the thing already, right? And so any like choose two of those is a compromise in some way, right? Either we have all the resources in our hands and we have all the time to talk through what we should do with those resources, and that's hoarding. Or we have all the resources and we have all the speed to leap into action and get shit done now, and we are trampling over stakeholders, right? Or like no matter what, we're hurting somebody in the process. No matter what, we're making a compromise. And the question is, which compromises are you able to live with? And contempt mechanics kind of come in. For anyone who hasn't played the game, I keep referencing them. The idea is you play collectively as a community at a bird's eye level. This is a map-making game. This is a interpreting the actions of a community across the course of a year game. So you're not role-playing as individual people, but rather amorphously representing the community as a whole together. But anytime that you narrate the actions of a community member or of a group of people within the community, there's a possibility that somebody in that community would be hurt by those actions. And there's a possibility that a player feels an attachment to a different outcome in the community. And so they can reflect that, not by saying, no, we shouldn't do that, because there's not place in the procedures of the game to do that. Instead, they can reflect that by taking a contempt token and their little skulls in the bagged set. So you take a little skull and you put it in front of you. And for some people, that little skull, you see someone reach for it and put it in front of them, and it can feel like really harsh. It can feel much more harsh than interjecting to argue, because it's already done, because that's part of what being a community is, right? Like no matter how long we spend talking something through, eventually somebody just does something. And those are actually unrelated, or they're not unrelated. Those are actually separate processes, right? We talk something through and then somebody does something, and we pretend like one flows immediately and inevitably into the other, but that's actually not true. I don't think that's how the world works. So the contempt mechanics are a way of voicing like, hey, I'm frustrated with you. And what does it mean to be in community with people when being in community is inevitably about compromises? It's inevitably about making imperfect choices, and people inevitably get frustrated with you. Hopefully the answer isn't, I get paralyzed with fear and I do nothing of consequence and eventually my community starves and dies. Hopefully the answer is like, I continue to make bold, imperfect choices based on my best knowledge and my best intentions and my best efforts. And I try and patch things up as I go, because I think that's how community works. And I think that the people who rock the boat the least get the least contempt piled up in front of them, but also do the least in terms of serving the ultimate needs of the community. So that's the premise of the game. And having talked it through, yeah, I think I still agree with that. I think I still agree with that, but I also think that it is a bit of a enabling set of beliefs, and that it really enables me to be like, well, I don't know, do I really want to take imperfect actions and invite contempt? So hopefully I design a different game at a different time in my life that has the premise that it's good to be a firebrand.
Yeah. Oh, I like that a lot.
And this is interesting, because I think I've said this on the podcast before, but I'm in the middle of a book club with my mother reading The Power Broker, the like massive biography about Robert Moses. And we have a call every week to discuss like our thoughts on power and, you know, what's happening with this person. And it's the thing that we keep talking about of like, this person's getting a lot done, but boy, howdy, is he hurting more and more people as he's doing it. And like, is that action worth it? Like, yes, you made a big, beautiful thing, but at what cost? And like, at what time is the communal hurt worse than the communal benefit? It's interesting. I hadn't made, and this is, I think this just happens when you read a book, like you start to see it in other things. And I hadn't thought about it in terms of The Quiet Year, which is interesting. It's the talk of the table.
Hey, it's Elliot from Many Sided Media, and I'm here to tell you about the second setting guide for the hit Hope Punk sci-fi TTRPG Dreams and Machines from our friends at Modiphius. If you haven't heard, Dreams and Machines is a Hope Punk sci-fi TTRPG about a world in the far future cut off from Earth where sleeping mechs form a part of the landscape and a part of the culture. This new setting guide, The Broken Steps, will give players a detailed overview of the Surienta Simio region, as well as brand new glyphs, talents, and equipment for player characters, and expanded rules for mounts and vehicles. But perhaps most excitingly, there are now rules for settlement building, so players and game masters can create these permanent, customizable communities that grow into societal hubs that forever leave your personal mark on Evra Prime, the world of Dreams and Machines. So if you want to pre-order The Broken Steps coming later this year, use code DREAMS10 at checkout and get 10% off the Game Master's Guide and the Player's Guide, everything you need to start playing.
Hey, this is Brian, and I just want to tell you about some cool new stuff from our friends at Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop minis with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your web browser. Hero Forge is constantly releasing new content, and they've just launched their latest feature, custom acrylic keychains. These keychains use the same technology as their color standees and are the perfect way to rep your beloved character when you're out in the world. They are highly detailed, ridiculously durable, and made of 1/8-inch thick acrylic featuring front and back color printing, measured on the same 30mm scale as Hero Forge minis and standees, which means they will be a one-for-one match for your heroes on the battle map. Plus, Hero Forge just released stainless steel minis. These are perfect for anyone who is looking for the retro feel of old-school minis. These stainless steel minis have a textured finish and a rugged, highly durable feel. So visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom keychains and steel minis today.
With your long forgotten name, we call upon you.
We call upon you.
In the words of the unspeakable language, we call upon you.
We call upon you.
By the spilt blood of the wicked who walk upon this world sprouting the words of false idols, we call upon you.
We call upon you.
On the land of the dead harvest, that which brings the earth itself into your service, Yamel, we call upon you.
We call upon you. We call upon you. We call upon you.
Yamel calls upon you.
The Sprouting, a Call of Cthulhu actual play podcast by Blighthouse Studio. Find us on your podcatcher of choice.
My dearest listener, have I got a secret for you? Bitterton is an improvised comedy podcast inspired by the stories of Jane Austen that tells the tale of a wealthy family's secrets, scandals, and shenanigans. Lady Bitterton has unwed daughters, nosy neighbors, awful country cousins, and now a body to hide. Will the Bitchertons be able to keep their secrets off the pages of Lady Bigwither's gossip sheet? Or will her pen skewer their good name forever? Oh, Bits, what a predicament. Featuring the voices of Katie Maravich, Iffy Waddyway, Carolyn Page, Alex Songsharp, Brian Flaherty, and Cassie Wilson, plus a dance card filled with guest comedians of the very finest quality. But for us to help the seeds of rumor ripen into the juicy plum of scandal, we'll need your help. Bitcherton is heading to Kickstarter on June 13th. Go to bitcherton.com to pre-save the campaign and help us bring this story to life. Ta-ta! For now.
You know, we spent a lot of time in the quiet year. I'd love to transition to, you know, some of your other designs that I think have had a lot of influence. And one of those, I think, is Monster Hearts and Monster Hearts 2nd Edition, Monster Hearts 2. And I feel like this game, to me, and we'll see if this is how you see its legacy, is that it is like one of the go-to reference brought up when it talks about bringing like messy queer romance and messy queer like sex and sexuality to the table, this is like a reference. And I'm curious, how do you see, kind of see the tools that you laid out in Monster Hearts and their influence for like telling messy queer stories? And like, was there a lineage that this followed as well that kind of maybe doesn't get brought up when Monster Hearts gets brought up?
Okay, the lineage is, it was the years between 2009 and 2011, and Twilight was really big. I think the first movie came out in 2009, a work of cinematic genius. But the books were, the book series was concluding around that time. And there was this really popular trend within the circles that I ran in of mocking the terrible writing of Twilight. And a lot of YouTubers would have, you know, like 30-minute long episodes where they just read through the text and they would have it up on the screen and they would highlight sections that were really cringeworthy, and they would just rant about how stupid and bad it was. And Twilight was primarily consumed by teenage girls, by young women, by women who were, you know, bored in their life, and they liked the excitement and the raciness that Twilight brought for them. And at a certain point, talking in a really snarky way, 2009 to 2011, that's like the height of snark culture, where the coolest thing you could do was to dunk on people publicly. And at a certain point, you're just hating women, right? It's just misogyny. The Halo novel series was being released at the same time. None of these YouTubers were putting up text from the Halo novel series and tearing it apart. And, you know, I haven't read the Halo novel series. I sincerely apologize if the authors of the Halo novel series listen to this podcast and are huge fans. But I have this sneaking suspicion that it was similarly trash or more trash. Why weren't we hating that? It was because boys liked it and girls liked Twilight. And so it was safe to hate on Twilight to prove how like intellectually superior you were, because the only people you were hurting were teenage girls by calling them idiots. And so that really irked me. And since I was contrarian, part of my personality from that point forward was, actually, I love Twilight. Twilight is great. I can explain to you at length why Twilight is really well constructed. And that was a belief entirely fueled by a desire to fight people who were getting a free pass on misogyny. But I became a little bit fixated for a little while. And at the same time, Apocalypse World had come out. And it was really exciting, the way that it created so many hooks into the design process and so many levers to pull. And story games in the time immediately preceding Apocalypse World, like 2006 to 2009, there were a lot of very self-contained, like little engine games. And Apocalypse World was like, what if we had just like a lot of pieces of Lego and people got to put them together in cool ways? And so it really invited playing around. And so I created on the Apocalypse World forums, which are called Barf Forth Apocalyptica, I created a move in the Apocalypse World style to capture the essence of Bella and Edward's relationship. And Shreya Sampet, a designer who I really respected and thought did amazing work, said, you need to make this. And so then I did. And that became like a year and a half of my life.
I'm always so happy when things that I like and are really good and are really big and bold and beautiful enter the world, and the root of them is kind of spite. in a way, I'm just like, that is the essence of the human experience in some ways, and I really love it.
I'm curious, what was that move, the Bella Edward capture move that you posted, if you remember offhand?
Yes, it involved strings, and it was set up in a way where strings were an implied mechanic that probably existed as part of the larger game, but they weren't defined within the move. So it's clearly like there are extant pieces that were implied, and it was a badly designed move. In addition to saying you need to make this, Shreyas pointed out, I think, a few other people as well, that like it was a badly designed move because it was attempting to play out the entirety of the dynamic within a single move, or is attempting to play out like the whole scene or both sides of the interaction. And I think moves as like a design technology are really great when they are listening for a specific, I try to do this, and they take that and they slingshot it in the direction of unexpected, messy middle outcomes. And then they just turn it back to the player and say, okay, so now what? That went half right. What do you do next? And so the move didn't attempt to do that because it gave three strings at once and it determined the emotions of the character that it was impacting. It didn't leave any fruitful void to explore during the rest of play. But yeah, it was strings were written into a move before Monster Hearts existed, or I'd figured out what strings were.
That feels like it's almost like what's it called? Like tossing your hat over the wall. Like you were putting something out there for someone to say like, hey, what's this?
What is this?
Finish it. Yeah. And you're like, I already threw my hat in the ring. I got to make it now. I really like that. One of the things that I really loved about rereading this game reading part of this game in preparation for this interview was I don't think I fully understood this the first time I read it, but was the completeness of the safety tools session or the safety tools section. Where I think we've read a lot of games, we've talked for My First Dungeon, for Talk at the Table, we've just been through a lot of games, and safety tools as a topic come up a lot. And I think Monster Hearts 2 has probably the most like complete section. When I say complete, the thing that I think I often see is there'll be a safety tool section where people are like, here's the X card, here's what lines and veils are, here's what they're trying to do. And that's very valid and it's helpful. But what I loved about what you did with safety tools was taking us through the entirety of what that process looks like. And there's a line in here that I really loved that was, these are our responsibilities to ourselves, to the others at the table, and to the people we're portraying. They're a series of nested circles with a responsibility to ourselves at the core. I'm curious, that is such a clear definition of safety tools. And then the section expands upon that going through using them at the table, reminding people to like take breaks, how to care for yourself after a session in a way that I really love. Going into this game, knowing that it was a game that dealt with sexuality and dealt with elements of consent and otherness, how did you approach safety tools? And what, in my opinion, incredibly successfully, what do you think made it so successful in its final iteration?
So in the first edition of Monster Hearts, I actually don't do a good job of spelling out safety tools. That was partially a reflection of where play culture was at the time that I was writing it. And it's partially and more accurately a reflection of my own like naivety as a designer. So that chapter on safety tools doesn't really come from me. It comes from Lillian Cohen Moore, who was writing a column for Bitch Magazine online. And the column was called Save Versus Sexism. And she put out an article called The Sexuality of Monster Hearts, where she unpacks what Monster Hearts is and how to play it, and said some really lovely things about the game, but also said, like, there is a major failing at the heart of this book, not necessarily this game, but this book. And that failing is that it doesn't attend to reader safety or player safety in a way that makes the game welcoming to women, especially women living with trauma. Something like that. And I'm paraphrasing. This was 13 years ago that article came out. But I was really struck by that. And I realized like, oh, absolutely. If I ever do another edition of this game, I want to include not only safety tools, because I don't think the game is particularly complete in terms of safety tools. It mentions or explains how to use one or maybe two of them. But what that chapter is doing, I think, is that it walks through the concept of cultivating safety, maybe with completeness. I would accept that as true. And there's lots of, because there's lots of documents that get into safety tools much more completely, like the TTRPG toolkit, an amazing resource. But yeah, Monster Hearts talks about what does it mean to feel safe? And what does it mean to be allowed to tell dangerous stories together because we feel safe? And what does it mean to attend to safety in order to explore risk and risky stories and racy stories together? I think a lot of the time there's this misguided assumption from detractors of safety tools and from a lot of people fighting on the right-wing side of the culture war, I guess, that trigger warnings, safety tools, and these things exist because we're trying to protect ourselves from ever having to feel anything hard. And it's like, no, we're putting these in place so that we can feel things that are hard and feel things that are actually way harder than we would have tolerance for otherwise. Like, we're doing this because we're sickos. we're the ones putting the things that need trigger warnings into the game. And that's why we want tools for managing trigger warnings.
Right. Oh, I love that. It is interesting. I'm going to be, we're putting trigger warnings because we're the sickos is so good. And a framing that I hadn't been able to put on it that I love that. I'm going to steal that for sure.
I do really like, because I've also been thinking about how to reframe safety tools, especially for our podcast, My First Dungeon, of making them a thing that is more, it doesn't feel like an obstacle in any way, that always feels like an exciting and a necessary part of playing a game. And I think part of that is remembering that, like, we're playing these games that are like fantastical and they're otherworldly. And in like regular life, we kind of have a set of table stakes of what is acceptable and what isn't. And the second we enter a world that has none of the realities of our world, or selective realities, or has heightened realities, we kind of need to just sit aside and be like, hey, what? Let's set up these table stakes. Let's set up some like understandings among people. And that's all that this really is. And what I loved about the Monster Hearts section is, I think, as you said, it talks about how to create a safe environment, even if it doesn't delve deep into the individual tools. And the reason I really love that is it has a vibe of teach a man to fish, not give a man a fish. You know what I mean? Like, by presenting a way for people to understand not only the how, but the why, feels like it will be much more effective and impactful in the long run, not only just for that game of Monster Hearts you're playing, but for all other games, than just having a really clear description of like X card lines and veils, stoplight mechanics, stuff like that. I think that's the thing I really wanted to call attention to, because I think it's so well done.
I think one of the other things that's been true about my design process, and I think this is true about most role-playing game designers, is that I've designed the games that I wanted to play at any given moment, but I've also designed games that teach me the things that I was wanting to learn in any given moment. And it makes sense that I designed Monster Hearts, the first edition, at a time when I was really grappling with my own sexuality and my own gender. And I designed Monster Hearts 2 and wrote that chapter and kind of approached it in a different way, 6 years later, at a time when I had come out, I was living in queer community, I had transitioned, but I wasn't feeling a lot of sense of safety in my community and in my body and in like some of the relationships that I had been exploring. I was holding a lot of hurt and I was struggling to figure out how to make sense of it. And so I think a lot of that was also like me telling myself like, hey, you're allowed to want to feel safe and you're allowed to prioritize feeling safe before you turn around and attempt to attend to the needs of others. Though that is also important. That's like the second most important thing you can do in any scenario. But the first most important is to make sure that you feel safe. Just to get really heavy and personal. And,
no, that's
and
really
go there.
No, I think it's great.
I really love that.
And I think that's the thing that gets repeated so much, is that like your first priority is to your own safety. And then it is that nested circles thing. And I also just, I've pulled out a couple of quotes that I just like really loved. And the other one is at the end of that safety tool section, which this is the thing I think every game should kind of have, because you go through a lot of safety tools and then you have a section of why we want to play this game. And the first line is kind of like, we just talked about all these safety tools and why it's dangerous. Let's remember why we're here to play. And it ends with the line, you play to get lost and to remember. And it's like, it's a very poetic line. It really pulls at your heartstrings, but especially it reminds you that you've just read a bunch of text about like how to be safe and like this is a dangerous space. Be careful, you know, treat yourself well, treat others well, treat your character well.
And it's fun.
And it's fun.
let's not lose the perspective of what this is. This is a game, and it is, you know, going back to the start of this conversation, it's a thing that can be buried without ceremony. We take from it what we will, but play within, you know, play safely.
I think one of the traps that you can get into in introducing safety tools and in engaging with them is that you can poison the collective kind of like headspace if you approach it in a way that is harsh and if you approach it in a way that is alienating. And there are some safety tools that I'm like, oh, I like probably actively wouldn't play a game, like a game where we sit down and the first thing is I'm handed a checklist and, you know, check all of the ones you don't want to explore. Rape, incest, racism, lynchings. And I'm like, you know, like there's 50 of them or 100 of them. There's no way I'm getting to the end of that list and feeling like doing anything fun with the rest of my day, right?
Yeah. Right.
I'm like, I need to go home and go to bed. Maybe it's just that I'm particularly fragile compared to the average person, but I don't think so. I think like that shit weighs on you. You carry it with you into the game. And I think safety tools are about striking the right balance for a given group, for a given social context, and for a given game's structures and narrative content for like, how do we bring up the fact that there's going to be stuff that is, you know, this emotionally difficult in a way that doesn't blow it out of proportion, in a way that doesn't shock people's nervous system in an unrecoverable way, right? How do we calibrate to getting as real as we ought to for a given context about the fiction that might come up without losing people and without skewing expectations in an unsavory kind of direction?
There was a thing, I was talking to Jay Dragon not too long ago. I think we were discussing Lines and Veils in some capacity, and I was kind of reminded, like, in my head, lines have started becoming like, those are things that are out of the game. And that is true. But really, like, the idea of a line is that's the line we will walk up to. Like, we're fine with going this far. And it is a thing that isn't in the game, but it's also a thing like we can approach that with care. And once we get to a certain point, that's where we stop. Like, we look over the edge there rather than crossing over. But it's not necessary. It doesn't necessarily have to be a let's remove this entirely and not go down that path. It's we'll come up to it as close as we can. And that's a fun space we're allowed to explore in.
Yeah, part of the reason why we name limits is because it's interesting to explore the limits.
Right.
Like exactly, explore up to them and not cross them, right? Yeah,
exactly. 100%. It's tough because I know in the quick way of saying lines and veils, it's veils are things behind the veil they exist in the world, but we don't talk about. And then lines are things we don't see. It's a quick way of saying it. And it's a way that I've probably fallen into saying it. But it's not the full, like, it is, as in with most things in life, more nuanced than that. And the point of it is to get you closer to those things in a safe way rather than just saying they don't exist. Elliot, you want to bring us into Belong Outside
the
Line?
No, I do. I'm worried we're going to run out of time. But I feel like, you know, as we transition to kind of one of the last bits that I want to talk about in terms of like the legacy of your work, I want to talk about Dream Askew, Dream Apart, and really the creation of Belonging Outside Belonging as a system that then now has spread out. And it feels like it is, as you're talking, the culmination of so many things that have come up in these other games of like, you know, community in the quiet year and like understanding what you want to learn about like your own sexuality and stuff like that. And I feel like Belonging Outside Belonging is the way that like, as a designer, I can say there's personal influence. I've like, through your work and then through people you've inspired, like Jay Dragon, like Jay's work has been a huge influence to me. And I feel like it's that when you said that thing of like, what are you learning about yourself as you design a game? It's like the more fascinated I've been with Belonging Outside Belonging games has always tracked personally with my growing in queer community and like being more open in my own queerness and like forming queer community. And these are games inherently about queer community. And this is a long rambling answer or question to say, like, what has the influence of Belonging Outside Belonging kind of, you know, meant to you, you know, on top of in how it's built on your other game's legacy and what you've seen in the last few years?
That's a really great question. Okay, so you mentioned that you don't want to run out of time. So I'll also mention that on my website, buriedwithoutceremony.com, there is a section about talks and workshops. And one of the talks that I highlight is a talk from Practice, which is an NYU Game Center conference, and I give a talk there. It's an hour-long talk that is specifically about the back-and-forth design dialogues between Dream Askew and Dream Apart, so between myself and Benjamin Rosenbaum. Dream Askew was originally released as a short Patreon like PDF, and then Benjamin came to me, I think like years later, saying like, hey, can I use this engine to do this game about shtetl life? And I was like, yeah, but can you tell me what your thoughts are? And as we went back and forth, I was like, oh, the thing that I designed was like missing essential pieces to like fully realize its vision. And like, you're designing them. I want to get in on this. And so like that back and forth was really essential. And it's what took Dream Askew from an interesting 13-page PDF to a fully realized game that I still really like bringing to tables today. And that's like the emphasis on relationship. And so I talk about that in that talk. But the thing that I really liked is that since putting out Dream Askew, Dream Apart, since introducing this idea of games of belonging outside belonging, that design dialogue has continued. And it, in a lot of cases, hasn't been like I put it out into the world and then other people did things with it. A lot of those connections actually have looped back to me. And I've gotten to still be in dialogue with them, which is really amazing. Jay developed Wander Home, developed other games that were kind of that riff off of Belonging Outside Belonging in different ways. Sleepaway as well, I think, was a Belonging Outside Belonging game. Jay, I got married a month ago. Jay was actually at my wedding.
Congratulations.
And at, you know, like in the downtime, it was like a weekend long summer camp affair. And so in the downtime on the Friday night, like I got to play test a thing that Jay was tinkering on. I'm doing design consulting for one of her upcoming games. Jess Levine, who did Going Rogue. Jess and I have talked about organizing and community like at length over the phone at different points throughout the years. Ray, who did Bellic Buy-In, I've done design consulting on several of Ray's games. And so there's been this really cool process. I think that the fact that they're games about community just inherently skews toward that kind of dialogue and reciprocity and connection. But also I think, I don't really know where I'm going with that thought, actually. It's been really exciting that a game designed through the interplay between designers and through that that dialectic process has persisted even like years after the game has been released, just with new people as well. And I think the sense of freedom of being like, here's this thing I made, make your own things with it, is something that I learned from Vincent and McGay Baker. Their kind of generosity and openness and inviting people to experiment. Like Dream Askew is a Powered by the Apocalypse game, even if the things that follow in its legacy might better be described as Belonging Outside Belonging games, in part because it wholesale rips off ideas of Vincent McGay's. The psychic maelstrom is a thing in both games. Like it's very obvious that it is like me doing a different thing with Apocalypse World at its heart. But their openness with like that kind of process kind of taught me a lot about openness with process and inviting people in and inviting people to collaborate and inviting people to tinker that I don't think I would have gotten there on my own. I would have been too covetous.
Yeah, that's really beautiful.
Man, and also, if you're going to be stealing stuff from people, the Bakers are absolutely the people to take it from. it's just all good stuff in there.
Yeah, and then figure out a way to pay it back to them, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I will say the Bakers are two other people who we've had on our list to have on this podcast for a long time, and we're both too intimidated by them to reach
out. Which is crazy because everything I hear from like friends who know them are like they're the nicest people. So we should just take our own advice and reach out.
They are genuine sweethearts and genuine community builders. So yeah, you should reach out.
I know, we should.
Yeah, man, there's a whole other conversation to have about belonging outside belonging that I'd love to dig in, but I love that sentiment. Like, that's at the core of it, I think, of the legacy of it that I have felt as a burgeoning designer, is that like when I find designers to be in community with and learn from, I feel like that system is always one that just keeps coming up, you know, like with, you know, people at my level who like the thing that we're most fascinated by and want to learn from is like riffs on the belonging outside belonging. So yeah, I love that.
It seems like we're just going to have you back for another conversation entirely about belonging outside belonging. Yeah. So, you know, we'll let you know. We'll find another time in your calendar. Do this again.
I mean, honestly, that would be amazing. Invite some other people who have designed belonging outside belonging games. Have a little roundtable moment.
Ooh, belonging outside belonging roundtable. Okay. That's
we
a good
idea.
We do
Patreon roundtables. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that'll be the thing.
That's a good one.
So, no, that's actually, that's going to happen.
That's going to happen for sure.
So we'll let you know. But before we get out of here, I know the last thing I wanted to make sure we touched on was your most recent game, the game that you've just released, Going for Broke. Can you tell us a little bit about that game and what it is and why this was the time to make it?
So Going for Broke is a game that I actually first designed in 2012, but at the time it was called Keep It Sunny. Yeah, there's a lot of my design stuff that's like circling back to finish ideas that I had during a very frenetic year a decade ago.
That's awesome.
But yeah, Keep It Sunny was a It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia tribute game.
There should be more Always Sunny in Philadelphia tribute games.
Absolutely, yeah. And it evolved over the years. It was spent most of the time sitting on the shelf gathering dust, and occasionally I'd pick it up and tinker with it. And I started working on it more seriously again last year because I kept having this same issue, which is that I would describe role-playing games to people and they would be so excited. I think the average person thinks that this stuff seems really cool. They like heard of Dimension 20, or they saw a Critical Role thing one time, or they like saw someone else playing a role-playing game and they're like, this seems amazing. I'd love to do that. And you're like, great, it takes 4 hours. And it's just like, like you can feel their heart drop, or like the air like sucked out of the room. And then you go on to say, at a minimum,
right?
On the short
end. And then you're
like,
and here's the 5-pound books you have to buy.
And a lot of people in my life who don't play role-playing games know that I'm a role-playing game designer and say, that's so cool. Could we play one? Could we play one right now? And I have to be like, no. The end. And I just got tired of saying no. And there are other games that are great for this type of thing. Alex Roberts' Starcrossed is a great example, but you just can't bring a Jenga tower everywhere with you. Fiasco is great as well. But I'm like, oh, I would love to have something that I could just forget is in my bag. Like my little like earbud headphones, right? They're there when I want them. And I can plug, you know, I can put them into my ears at any moment, but I don't feel their weight carrying it around. So it's like, I just want something that like plays super fast, is super accessible, has no fantasy tropes, has no acronyms, has no math, and has no strange vocabulary, strange materials. And so that's why it felt like it was important to design this game. And also it was fun to get to tell kind of like wild, rambunctious stories. But the biggest thing, the thing that made me actually take it to publication was I wanted something that I could put into my purse and forget was there. And then the next time that someone asked me, like, could we play a role-playing game? Do you have one with you? Could we play one tonight? I could finally just say, like, yes.
I love how much of your, throughout this conversation, I love how much of your game design is built on, I almost want to say like an entrepreneurial mindset of, I saw a problem and I wanted to build a game to fix that problem, rather than just kind of a wholesale, let me create a game. It's, I want a game I can fit in my purse. I'm making Going for Broke. I want a game that makes Twilight exciting. I want to prove to people that Twilight is good. Monster Hearts.
Definitely, yeah. Dream Askew, the reason that it existed in the first place is I was running weekly drop-in, new player-friendly story game sessions in a rotating series of coffee shops. They were loud. They were crowded. We had to pack into a small table. We had 3 hours, including intro and including explaining to people what a role-playing game was. And one time I was trying to run Apocalypse World with a young single mother who needed to take multiple breastfeeding breaks for her newborn that she had with her, and someone who had recently gone off their meds and was having a lot of trouble focusing. And so Dream Askew is just the Apocalypse World for that exact scenario. Because I was in that scenario and I tried to run Apocalypse World and it didn't quite work. Because people kept on having to step away to order a drink, step away to, you know, do something else. Someone was breastfeeding and they were really focused on their baby. And they're like, okay, what's happening? And it didn't quite work in that scenario, and that's why Dream Askew came to exist. Dream Askew also doesn't quite work in that scenario, but that was the design impetus behind it.
Doesn't matter if you succeed at it all the way, as long as you've got a focal point and you're moving towards it. You're closer than you were at the start, and that's the goal of it.
There we go. Yeah, and Going for Broke actually does complete that design journey.
Yeah.
There you go.
It does feel like that's a really fun thing here, like kind of stepping through your career of design, that there is a really nice through line loop that sometimes loops back on itself, but you can feel this DNA between all these games that also are all very different. It's a really nice.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'd also just love the reminder of the game that you put out now, you started in 2012. Like, there are so many, especially for anyone who's creative and like making some kind of creative endeavor, painting, art, movies, whatever. The thing that you made 10 years ago probably isn't fully good or done, but it's still worthwhile. There was still something about it that you were excited about. Dust it off, see if there's parts or pieces that you can pull from, and like maybe that blossoms into a great thing. And even if it doesn't, seeing where you were 10 years ago will probably better inform and better crystallize what you're trying to do now.
Absolutely. I started working on a sports supplement to Monster Hearts in 2017. It has spent most of the time on the shelf. 2 weeks ago, the like core mechanic, like the way I needed to rework it, clicked. And so sometimes it just takes a minute, and it's best to like attend to things when the inspiration strikes you, and like then document where you're currently at and put it on the shelf when it doesn't.
Can't wait for that.
Avery, is there anything else you want to make sure we get in before we give you our last question?
Yeah, I guess I would just mention I have a couple projects that I'm working on. I mentioned Monster Hearts Can't Lose, which is the sports supplement. I'm hoping to put that into playtesting in the next couple months. It's been through a couple rounds before, but I think this is it. I think we're gonna hit the right structure and setup for it. So that's going to be coming out. That's going to be coming into playtesting soon. I'm also working on a game design book. It's called Game Design for Creatures. It kind of explores what it means that you are an animal and you're designing games to be played for other animals. And what does it mean to have kind of a bit of an animal first design ethos rather than like a thinky thoughts design ethos. And that's just informed from years of teaching game design, running game design workshops, and doing design consulting, and seeing like, oh, I think you didn't start from the premise that the things that play your games are animals, and they like to touch stuff, and they like to get to have experiences that are tailored to all of their animalness. So I'm working on Game Design for Creatures, and it's going to come out hopefully sometime in the next year. I'm guesting at a couple conventions in September for anyone who's in Canada. The second weekend of September, I am in Kamloops, BC for CamCon. And the final weekend, I think, of September, I am in Montreal for Queerness in Games Conference. And I am keynoting there, which I'm really excited about because I first presented there in 2013 in the small room. And we packed the room. It was standing room only. People were spilling out in the hallway. I was like, this is amazing. And now I get to come back and talk in the big room. So kind of full circle.
And again, pack it out, spilling into the hallway, full circle moment. It's really convenient for an interview show that so much of your career has been circles and through lines. So thank you.
Yeah, that rules.
It helps us a lot. Avery, thank you so much for joining us on Talk at the Table. I know you listened to the show, so you know the last question that we're going to ask is, what are you bringing to the table? Which is just our cute way of asking you for a recommendation for our audience. It could be inside tabletop, outside tabletop. It could be a book, a person, an idea, a song, anything you like. What are you bringing to the table?
I've got three, if it's okay. There's a book about games that I've been reading. It's called Engines of Desire, and it is a LARP theory book by Johanna Peterson from Finland. It's very like highbrow Nordic LARP kind of theory stuff. But there are pieces in there that I've like run to find a highlighter to like run back to the book and highlight. So that's been really, really interesting. It's just like a different design world than I'm in. But there's enough overlap that it feels really fruitful to read. Play-wise, the last game that I played that really impacted me in a powerful, exciting way was Red Carnations on a Black Grave. It is based on the same engine as Monsigur 1244. So historical structured freeform about a tragedy and the inevitability of that moment. But it's set during the Paris Commune. So leftist kind of anarcho-socialist uprising in Paris in the 19th century that, you know, like utopia here in the streets for 3 weeks before we get gunned down by the army. It is bleak, but it's full of moments of like such poignancy. And so Red Carnations on a Black Grave, amazing game. And then finally, seasonally, not game related, it's been beautiful lately. And I've been spending more time walking in the forest and specifically remembering to just like pause and sit down and just kind of like breathe it in for 5 or 10 minutes. So highly recommend finding a random spot in the forest and sitting down in it.
Thank you so much, Avery Alder, for coming to the table. Do you want to let our audience know where they can find you online if they're looking for you?
BuriedWithoutCeremony.com is where all of my games are and where any talks, workshops, or other materials I put together are also linked. And then on social media, depending on character limits for usernames, I am either going to be Buried Without Ceremony or Lacking Ceremony.
And if you want more gamey content from us here at Talk of the Table, you can join the Many-Sided Media Discord or sign up for the Many-Sided newsletter. You can also support Talk of the Table on the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you get ad-free episodes as well as some fun bonus roundtables, including maybe soon a Belonging Inside Belonging roundtable that we're going to be setting up after this.
It's happening.
Please remember to rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.